Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 2:05 p.m. on Tuesday, April 1st, 2015. Present today, we have Co-Chair Representative Newman, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Representative Gaddis, Representative Munoz, Representative Guerra, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. They interfere with the recording equipment. On today's schedule, we'll have our second hearing of House Bill 158 and House Bill 41. We will be taking public testimony on House Bill 158 and House Bill 41, and if it is the will of the committee, I intend to move both of these bills today. We'll also have our introductory hearing on House Bill 13. I do not intend to move House Bill 13 from committee today. For our first bill up today, we have House Bill 13, an act repealing the authority to include certain materials from a policy political party in the election pamphlet. This is by Representative Lynn and Representative Guerra. Here to present House Bill 13 is Representative Lynn and his staff, Joanna Lewis. If you would both please come up, place yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation of House Bill 13.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I'm Bob Lynn, representing District in South Anchorage. Again, thank you for hearing the bill today. This bill is about the official Alaska election pamphlet. Because the pamphlet is published by the government of the state of Alaska, it carries an aura of authenticity far beyond that of canned pillars that stuff our mailboxes during the election seasons. As a result, voters tend to give far more credence to the words in the election pamphlet than they do the words in campaign mailers most of us mail out when we're trying to get elected or reelected. The pamphlet is also something of a campaign equalizer, because almost every candidate of whatever personal means can afford to advertise in a pamphlet whatever the amount of their campaign funds. The pamphlet is basically a vote-for-me publication for candidates, judges, and initiatives. As we know, candidates can write almost anything they please, however ridiculous it may be, without editing by the state, and I think that's perfectly okay. Unfortunately, there's a section now in the pamphlet where any registered political party can make statements. Some of these statements are hit pieces on some candidates or other political parties. If the political parties are allowed to continue to advertise in the pamphlet, we can expect the parties to escalate the attacks on other parties or on individual candidates. That's simply not appropriate in what's supposed to be a neutral governmental publication by the state of Alaska. The pamphlet is supposed to be about who and what we can vote on. We don't cast ballots for parties at the ballot box. We vote for individual people, and we vote on initiatives. This bill simply eliminates political party advertisements in the official election pamphlet. And I urge you to pass the bill.
All right. Any questions from the committee or the sponsor? Representative Gaddis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I, too, saw that saw some pieces in the back of that pamphlet this year. And do you know the history? I mean, how did I didn't notice it before, but I'm not necessarily – maybe it was there for a long time. I didn't notice. So what's the history?
What's wrong?
The history, how did it come to be that we allowed political parties to advertise, or I would ask the question even further, do we allow anybody to advertise in there?
It's any political party. Well, of course, any candidate, any initiative, and any political party. Do you have any information on that, or my co-sponsor?
Actually, we actually have Gail Fenumia.
Fenumia,
thank you. I don't know if she's in the audience or online. I believe she's in the audience.
Mr. Chair, I may be able to help on that one.
Online. Yes. Maybe she could answer that question for you, Representative Gaddis. Gail, are you there where you can hear us?
I'm online, yes, and I can hear you.
Place yourself on the record, and Representative Gaddis had a question that you might be able to answer.
Gail Fenumia, Director of Division of Elections. through the chair, Representative Gaddis. The state law currently only allows for political parties to purchase pages in the pamphlet. That is outside of the information that can be voluntarily provided by candidates running for office.
Follow up, Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Gail, how long have we been doing that? What's the history of that?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, I can only speak to the time I've been at the division. So for the past 20 years, that's been the practice. That's what the state law has allowed for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the history is, right, it's been around for a long time. And what parties have done, nobody's ever noticed because party platforms are about the most boring thing you could ever read. And so parties have taken those two pages and they put their party platforms in. And it was only this past year that one of the parties figured out we could actually do personal ads. And now that that's been figured out, you can probably see the escalation coming in the future. But I guess in response to your question, I guess I would ask Ms. Finumi, am I correct with that until this past year it's generally just been parties taking out that space so they can do party platforms?
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
Sure. Until this past election, this provision, it didn't jump out at anybody because really parties were just taking out the space to do party platforms. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that is correct.
Follow up?
No, it was only this year, Mr. Chair, that one of the parties figured out you could do ads against a candidate. And so then Representative Lynn and I sat down together and we said, well, we don't know which party is going to do it. They're probably all going to do it. They could target any person in the legislature, any candidate they want, any federal candidate, and essentially we just don't think that the state should be paying and subsidizing negative ads.
Gail, I'm curious. We have a zero physical note, but how much money is brought in from advertising in there, and what's the effect with that?
I couldn't tell who answered that, Mr. Chairman, I believe. The political parties pay $600 a page for the pages that they put in the pamphlet, and they are allowed to put in up to two pages if they so choose.
Okay, so there is.
And I believe in this last, the 2014 pamphlet, there were a total of four political party pages, so that brought in about $2,400.
So there actually is a physical impact, but not very big. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if I may, I'll just stick with Ms. Gale. Ms. Gale, so there, prior to this year, has there ever been any reports or complaints about the ads or the pages that are allowed for political statements?
That is correct. To the best of my recollection, this was the first year we received complaints about the information that was printed in the pamphlet.
I have a couple follow-ups, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
Yeah, Ms. Gale, so is there any site boards that are currently in place that talk about what can be stated there and who can do it?
No, the law just says they can provide information. They can purchase two pages. There are no limitations or clarification as to what is accepted or not accepted. The division accepts what is provided by candidates and the parties. We do put a statement at the bottom of each page that the information is paid for and provided by that entity, and it is not from the division.
Continue, Representative Newman.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hill, so any political party, is that who's allowed to do this? It's prescribed to just political parties, but any political parties within the state of Alaska that are recognized by the Division of Elections because of the voter turnout are available to put information in there?
That is correct. Any recognized political party has an opportunity to do so.
Since this complaint, there's been a complaint last year about it, is have you looked at maybe adopting some sideboards that looked at what could be or could not be placed in there? I mean, you've had to have addressed, looked at this, thought about it.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yes, Ms. Gale. since there was an issue this year in the last election pamphlet, I'm sure that you've thought about what sideboards could be put on that. Could you talk to us about that? If you have thought about what sideboards could be put on there to make sure that it didn't move forward with a negative impact?
The division has not thought about that at all. I'm sorry.
Okay, I think you just don't want to maybe talk about what you thought about, but I think you probably talked about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt and Representative Wilson have joined us. We have Representative Kawasaki next.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I guess, just a curiosity for Ms. Fanumi. Can it be any political party at all, whether they've got a candidate in the election cycle or not?
It can be any recognized party. It does not matter if they have a candidate running for any office.
Okay, and then I have something.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
In the pamphlet section where candidates write their statements and biographies, we get the two-pager, and we're supposed to send it in electronically. And I swear it says that you're not allowed to talk about the other person. Is that just my thinking, or is that... I swear that it said you have to keep it positive in the sponsor statement. Is that correct?
Through the chair, there are no provisions, to the best of my knowledge, that state what the subject matter of a candidate statement can be. There are limitations as to the number of words that can be in the biography and the candidate statement.
Okay. Okay, thanks. I just, for some reason, I remember the statement has to be about you and not about the other person. I swear that was part of the requests that come through from Division of Elections.
Okay, next we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The answer I heard, just for clarification, was no, there are not such standards. This one. Ms. Fanumi, is that correct? There are no standards? Ms. Fanumi, a question to you. I just want to confirm your answer to the previous question. Are there or are there not standards as to what candidates can put in their statements in the pamphlet?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Third time's a charm. I just want to make sure I clearly understood that you said there are not standards for the language used by candidates in the official election pamphlet. No standards.
You broke up there after you said something about candidates. I'm sorry.
I didn't hear her. What'd she say?
She broke up.
Okay, one more time. Are there standards that the candidates must follow in the pamphlet? Yes or no?
No, there are
no. Good deal. Thank you. I apologize. That's just to clarify. My actual questions, I want to go. Ms. Fanumi, under the First Amendment, could there possibly be any limits on political speech?
I don't feel qualified to address that question.
Is John McKay in the House?
Representative Lynn.
My staff checked on that with legislative legal, and there are no First Amendment problems here at all.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Follow up, Representative Sadler.
There's no First Amendment problems with removing advertisements, but limiting the content of advertisements would violate the First Amendment.
I'm going to let my staff here, because she's the one who spoke directly to Let's Legal this afternoon.
Ms. Lewis?
For the record, my name is Joanna Lewis, staff to Representative Bob Lynn. My understanding after speaking with Let's Legal was that you can limit who is allowed to put information into the pamphlet. It has to be across the board, though. You couldn't limit it to one party putting in a political statement, but if you just want to take out both political parties, that's just fine. You can do that.
Good, thank you.
And one last brief if I may follow up on that.
Dave Lynn, go ahead.
Going back to the previous comment, it's always been my understanding that when I write my vote for me statement in the election pamphlet that I can't mention the other candidate's name or do any political attacks on my opponent. It has to strictly be about me.
It follows up with what Representative Kawasaki thought. Representative Chandler has another question.
My last two questions here. I understand, Ms. Funumiai, that the pamphlets, election pamphlets, are open to advertisement from any party. Two questions. How many parties are currently eligible? And in the past, have all the eligible parties tended to take advantage of the opportunity, or has it just been what I'll call the two main parties?
Through the chair, all recognized parties in the state have an opportunity to provide information in the pamphlet should they choose, and there are currently four recognized political parties in the state.
And which are they, please?
The recognized political parties are the Alaska Democratic Party, the Alaska Libertarian Party, the Alaska Republican Party, and the Alaskan Independence Party. And in the 2014 pamphlet, the Alaska Democratic, Alaska Libertarian, and Alaska Republican Party purchased pages in the 2014 general election pamphlet.
And can you speak generally to your tenure at Division of Elections as to whether all parties take place ads or just a couple?
I'm sorry, could you say it again?
Yeah, just historically, do all eligible parties tend to take advantage of the opportunity or only a couple?
I mean, all eligible parties, see, in the past it seems like basically the two major parties have been the ones who have been providing information in the pamphlets.
And that's what I thought. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was the chairman of my political party in the past, and it's an interesting question. And, you know, when you're operating at that level, the nature of what a political party is significant. Ms. Funumiai, what is preventing a new political party being formed on a given election and trying to get a page in the ballot, on the ballot book?
In order to become a recognized political party, they have to they form and they run a candidate for governor who receives at least 3% of the total votes cast in the preceding general election. If there's not a race for governor, then we just look at the U.S. senator race. If there's not a U.S. senator race, we look to the U.S. representative race. So by the time the pamphlet is published, the political parties are already set for that year.
If I may, Mr. Chair, another follow-through. So in the next election cycle, presidential, there are many political parties with having presidential candidates on the ballot. If somebody came up from the political party of Florida that had a presidential, I'm just making up a political party, that had a candidate on the ballot for president of the United States, would that party be prevented from having a page in the election book?
I don't believe that would qualify. I need to look up what the definition of political party is in our statutes. It means an organized group of voters that represents a political program and ran a candidate, like I mentioned earlier, for either governor, United States Senate, or Republican, United States Representative, excuse me.
Okay. So, if I may, I'm just thinking about what sideboards, and we use the term sideboards, but when you're talking about political free speech, do you think your division is capable of sustaining a challenge by doing anything that would put sideboards on something?
Again, I think that's a question better answered by the attorneys than myself.
Okay. Is it, if I may, has it ever come up before? Have you ever had a challenge for something in one of these books? I mean, you've been there for a long time. You have a lot of history. So has this ever been an issue before?
To the best of my knowledge, I do not recall a challenge as such.
Okay, that's it for now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis.
I'm sorry, I forgot the question. I do think that it piggybacked on Representative Kawasaki's original question, so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Sure.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed we have two different versions. There was the original version, version /H, several pages long. And then this is a committee substitute from State Affairs, which is version N. Could you explain the differences between the two versions and why they were changed?
Yeah. The original version of the bill included...
on the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The original bill had a section in it that about the postage, that we would pay for the postage if somebody sent in an absentee ballot that didn't have adequate postage. I believe the Department of Elections would take care of that. That was taken out. That's why we got the zero fiscal note, leaving only the question about what political parties can do in the ballot. And by the way, I do have a copy of the book here and a couple of pages if anybody wants to look at it.
Representative Sadler? Representative Newman had a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lynn, I had a separate question. Have you talked to any of the parties that normally advertise in this to ask do they have recommendations to try and work out some type of accommodations so that the parties would have the opportunity to talk about their political platforms, but in a positive way? Have you approached the different political parties?
No, I've not approached my own party. I've not approached any of the other parties. I believe most of the political parties would like to gain an advantage over the other competing political parties. And my whole point on this is it's not appropriate to do hit pieces in the election pamphlet, either by a candidate or by any political party. I just think it's inappropriate, and that's the basis for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just see that we've got maybe some copies of information, the ones that was put in the last political party, but we don't have any copies of ones that were in prior ones that don't seem to have issues with them.
I do not. I just have the one for the last election, and it's here.
Yeah, I've got it in my packet.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fanumi, I'd like to ask your help in giving us a understanding of the basic economics of producing the official election pamphlet. How much of the cost of producing an advertisement page paid for by a party is paid by that party, and how much is subsidized by the division? And the same question for the candidate pages.
The division, it cost the division $256,000 to produce the official election pamphlet. And as I mentioned earlier, the party pages brought in about $2,400. I do not have a number as to how much revenue was generated from the candidate pages. I'd have to go back and do a count of how many candidates there were, and I can get that information to the committee if you would like.
Okay. So it's fairly clear that the Division of Elections is paying some or a lot of the cost of the advertisements and the candidate page.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So to the sponsor, so if the concern is that this was negative, why are we choosing to just eliminate the parties, period? Obviously, if there's history there, I mean, why are we trying to, why don't we just basically indicate, like Representative Kawasaki had indicated, that you're just not allowed to attack the other party or their candidates?
Negative is often in the eyes of the beholder. And it, you know, what might be negative to me may not be to you. And again, we vote for candidates listed in here. We vote for initiatives. We vote to retain or not retain judges. We don't vote for a political party. You don't vote for any political party because they're never on the ballot. Only their candidates are on the ballot.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay, so if negativity is in the eye of the beholder, then I have a problem with all the initiatives. We shouldn't be allowing them in there either because there's negatives on both sides there. If it's in the eye of the beholder, then I could argue that even though they may not be attacking someone else, they may be saying derogatory things about the other individual without using them by names. If we're really going to go to that point, then we could micromanage this thing down to saying that we shouldn't have a pamphlet. I don't understand why we would indicate specifically that parties, which exist whether you like them or not, if your concern is with the negativity, address the negativity. Why pull them all the way out? I mean, there's no reason. I mean, we've got some of the, and I'm even talking about some of our smaller parties, the Congress Party, these different ones, who may not have a platform to be able to get out there because they're smaller. I don't understand why we're going to penalize them all because we're concerned with that negativity. And if it's negativity is in the eye of the beholder, I could pull out many things in the pamphlet that would highlight what I could probably consider negative if that was my choice.
Once again, we vote for candidates, we vote for initiatives, we vote on judges. We don't vote yes or no on any particular political party. And I suppose negativity is in the eyes of the beholder, but nonetheless, why is it in here to begin with? We're not voting for any political party. We're voting for candidates, voting on judges, voting on initiatives.
And I can follow up one more time, but there's assumptions made there. There actually are people that still vote by political party. Both sides of the aisle. They vote by political party. To indicate that that doesn't exist, even though we're looking for a spirit of bipartisanship, would be falsely not recognizing what exists. So even with the argument of saying that there are that we don't vote political parties, there are individuals that do. And so if your concern is the negativity, then address the negativity. If your concern is that you just don't like parties, then that's probably what this bill is. But I think we're jumping from the negativity discussion and penalizing all the parties, whether it's the big ones, the two main ones, or some of the smaller ones, with the opportunity to potentially say, hey, these are our values. And if that's the case, then address the same kind of rules like we have that say, you know, don't attack someone else if that's the concern that you're trying to get at.
Through the chair, they know a lot about what party different candidates are. It's right. You have your name and you have what party you are on your page. And so people who vote strict party line, they can look and see what party you belong to, and if they choose to do so, can vote party line for everybody in their party.
Okay. We've got a couple more committee members that want to make comments. We do have two bills that will have public hearing today, and they're going to take up quite a bit of time. So if we could rush through this. Representative Wilson.
Right, and I know this is first turn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why not just charge them more? I mean, why are we subsidizing in the first place? I mean, in this bill, I mean, we just had a bill yesterday, I think it was yesterday, on making more electronic available, and even on this one, to where I get six mailed to me because my kids all still have my address as theirs. And so I don't really need six of them because I already know I'm voting for me. I think we should charge more. I'd like to see that in the bill, that we're going to actually charge more for the pages. We're in a crisis, and we're $256,000 we're paying to have this mailed to people. So, you know, as we're looking at this bill, I think if we don't like what they do, at least get more money out of them. So if you could just see how much we would have to charge, including the candidates as well, so that the state isn't subsidizing elections. Thank you.
Representative Edgman has a quick question.
Well, I wanted to ask Ms. Luna my quick question.
Go ahead.
Gail, Representative Edgman here. Is there anywhere else within the whole spectrum of the election process, and I'm thinking about everything from signs being, at least a couple hundred feet away from polling places to every step of the way in the election process that's essentially based on neutrality? I mean, is this the only part of the election process where you can't have a partisan outside of the candidate statements, which and the initiatives, which are accepted fact of life? But is there any other realm, anywhere else within the election process, you can actually pay to have a partisan statement under the stamp of the election process?
Gail?
Well, I vote that you can't hear us.
must be away from the phone right now.
I'll address it later.
We are going to have this bill back before us so we can ask additional questions, and everybody has a chance to absorb it a bit, and we'll be asking questions about what do other states do, things like that, because what do they do the same things that we're doing? So I'd like to ask for closing statements from the sponsor, Ms. Lewis.
Yes, thank you very much. This bill is not about how much money we may or may not get to the state. We all need more revenue, of course. It doesn't matter to me whether these statements by political parties are free or they cost $1 million a page. That's not the point. The point is political party advertising don't belong in the election pamphlet, but individual candidate statements and initiative statements and judge retention statements, they do belong in there, and I think we should try to keep the election pamphlet as pure as we possibly can. It's not about how much money we earn or don't earn as a state on this thing. And again, I would urge you that you pass the bill, maybe at the next session.
All right, Representative Lynn and Ms. Lewis, thank you very much for your presentation. At this time, I'll be putting House Bill 13 aside. Our next bill today is House Bill 158, an act relating to a refined fuel surcharge, relating to the motor fuel tax, relating to a qualified dealer license, and providing for an effective date. This is by Representative Munoz. We do have a finance CS before us, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to introduce committee substitute for House Bill number 158, version 29-LS06-08/I, dated 4/1/15, for committee discussion and referral.
Seeing no objections, we'll be addressing the CS / I version.
Grace and beauty in motion.
Good coming.
The CS for HB 158 version / I is before the committee for discussion. Ms. Pearson, please place yourself on the record and explain the differences between version E and version I.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson, and there are actually two changes from version E to version I. The first appears on page 2, line 6, and it exempts aviation fuel from the surcharge imposed under AS 4340-055. The second is on page 5, lines 1 through 9, and it conforms with federal grant assurances and FAA guidance to use aviation fuel taxes for capital or operating costs for airports. And those are the two changes in this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Here to present House Bill 158 is Representative Munoz and her staff, Crystal Coleman. Are you here, Crystal? There you are. Please come forward, place yourself on the record, and briefly give us a recap of House Bill 158.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Crystal Keenum, and staff to Representative Munoz. House Bill 158, as a recap, would add a 1 cent surcharge on all refined fuels. As Ms. Pearson mentioned, it does now exempt aviation fuel in the list of exemptions. I can go into more detail on any of that if it's the committee's wish.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Conlon. In the CS, we eliminate the fuel tax for jets, for jet planes, airplanes, yet we changed also on page 6 the fact that you can use those for aviation in airports. You added funds from this account for capital and operating costs for airports. So we added the legislature may appropriate the funds for capital and operating costs for legislatures was added, but yet we're taking the tax away from airlines. Why would we do that?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Section 5, 4340.010E is existing language that's in statute. It was clarified by adding motor fuel in there to ensure that there wasn't any confusion of what taxes were collected by that. Currently, motor fuel is the only tax that's collected into that fund right now, and this just clarifies that that's the way that it would remain.
Follow-up, Representative Newman.
The way I read this, thank you, Mr. Chair, the way I read this on page 5, line 8, the words were added to existing statute, capital or operating costs for airports, and the words aviation facilities was eliminated. So to me, that means that we can use this motor fuel tax, which was for cleanup for the car, to put into capital and operating costs for airports.
Mr. Co-Chair, the language previously, you are right, used to say for aviation facilities. We have expanded that for capital or operating costs of airports. But this language was never, in current statute, isn't for SPAR, and it never was. For more clarity, I believe Ken Alper and Brandon Spanos are online if you would like a little more clarity on that.
Yeah, we do have Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division, and Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division, on the line if we have questions for them. You have a follow-up, Representative Newman?
Mr. Chair, I'm confused. I thought that this bill was for hazard and oil and hazardous substance related prevention and spill response fund to clean up fuel that gets spilled, whether it's fuel that's on an airport or fuel that's in a marine or fuel that's on a highway or however that is. But then I'm confused as to why we would put language in that allows money. We're taking it away from aviation, but then we allow it to be appropriated for capital and operating costs for airports, which is not cleaning up. It's not cleaning up fuel. Why would we do that?
Mr. Co-Chair.
I don't know. I just don't know.
It's there was some conforming language that needed to be drafted in this to delineate the difference between the motor fuel tax that's collected by the state and this new surcharge. So not only in Section 5, but there are other conforming statutes throughout this bill, throughout 158, that do reference just the motor fuel piece specifically to truly delineate between what's collected for the Department of Revenue to administer.
Mr. Chair, I know that you and I work on the operating and capital budgets, and you and I probably wouldn't go to this fund to use those for capital and operating, but maybe you and I won't be here. And if you're attempting to fix conforming language in current statute within this that does allow that to happen, maybe we should take a better, a little bit longer look at this and fix it so that it doesn't do that, is what I guess I'm saying. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The bill sponsor, Representative Munoz, would like to.
Mr. Chairman,
speak to this.
The fuel that's collected on aviation is required to go back to the airports, and I think Mr. Alper can address that issue for you. This does not relate to the SPAR. It's only clarifying language that was requested by the department.
Mr. Alper, are you online?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I am.
Place yourself on the record, and maybe you can answer what Representative Munoz had a statement on there.
Certainly, I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper, A-L-P-E-R. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. And to clarify for Representative Newman's question, the most of the bill, which is the unedited language, is from our existing tax on motor fuels, where we collect a different tax, a different amounts on different types of fuel, aviation, highway fuel, marine, and the like. So the existing language, which is what's in Section 5, is being clarified that money, which is roughly $5 million a year, must be spent on projects at airports. That's to conform with some new guidelines from the Federal government over how fuel taxes collected on aviation fuels must be treated. So that's a little bit conforming. It's slightly outside the scope of the specific SPAR bill before you, but we're in the same section, and it satisfies an existing need that will be, as I understand it, addressed in the budget documents as well, where some of the money that is currently appropriated for airports is going to be specifically tied back to the aviation fuel that's coming in on a year-to-year basis from our motor fuel tax. The exclusion of aviation from this new surcharge is a separate issue that it doesn't impact the change in Section 5 at all. It does, however, reduce the scope of what will be subject to this new one-cent surcharge. And that was, I'm not entirely certain of the full background on that, but I see the language in the bill.
Representative Newman has a follow-up question, Mr. Alper.
I have a couple, Mr. Chair. So I understand I've had the Department of Transportation Public Facilities budget for a couple of years. And my co-chair has it this year, that the money collected for airports goes back into airports. I get that. This can be used now so that they collect a surcharge on the tax that's sold for aviation and you use that. And this is, I guess you're trying to say, can use for capital or operating costs anywhere within the airports. I'm trying to make sure we're clear here.
Yep, certainly. Through the chair, Representative Co-Chair Newman, the taxes, the existing taxes not affected by this bill on aviation fuel are 3.2 cents per gallon on jet fuel and 4.7 cents per gallon on general aviation fuel. That fuel, which is currently in more or less a sub-account of the general fund, is being specifically designated now for capital projects at airports. That's the purpose of the change made in Section 5. Were aviation fuel not excluded in Section 2, meaning from the new surcharge, we would then have to find similar language to make sure that that fuel was also directed in some way to aviation activity.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can kind of just follow up on that,
follow up.
A couple more. So this doesn't include if an airplane with a jet engine is the only one that would qualify for this, if it lands at another remote airport that doesn't fall, one that's not a municipal airport or one that's not Ted Stevens International, Fairbanks International. They're the only, all the other airports within the state of Alaska fall under DOT PF's expenses. So if a jet lands at Dead Horse and there's a fuel spill, which is a state-operated airport, then could you use this for capital projects up there then?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, to be clear, the language about capital projects is about existing what has been considered general fund aviation motor fuel taxes, similar to the 8-cent gasoline tax. If money wished to be spent on cleanup-type activities at airports, then a funding source would need to be identified because right now the purchases of aviation fuel are not going to be paying into the SPAR surcharge.
And Mr. Chair, then the question would be asked, if there was a spill at one of these airports, could they use SPAR funds to clean it up?
And through the chair, that would probably be a question better addressed to the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm not exactly certain of their operational protocol.
I'm assuming that if the boat coming in to fill up Ted Stevens International Airport in Anchorage and their contingency plan, and that fuel is to be used there because the fuel goes from the distributor charge to the user, that if they had a fuel spill while transporting that over there to Ted Stevens International with their tanks, they had a spill, that the spill prevention response teams would respond to that spill and use it to clean it up, but yet there wouldn't be paying a cent into that fund.
And Mr. Co-Chair, and Kristen Ryan from DEC is here, but for a situation like that, my understanding is that DEC, while they would go and initially respond to the spill, they would work with the entity and the company that was involved with the spill to recoup costs. And so the burden would then, and cost recovery would come from the entity that spilled.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's standard practice for every spill anyhow. So if we could maybe hear from DEC.
Well, I wouldn't mind reading something, if I might, sure. Mr. Co-Chair. Federal grant assurances, 49 U.S.C. 47107B, states that that assurance 25 requires that any local taxes on aviation fuel will be expended by the airport for capital and operating costs of the airport. Using monies derived from the airport system for non-airport uses, like cleaning up heating oil spills, et cetera, is likely clearly a grant assurance violation. In November of 2014, the Federal Aviation Administration identified taxes on aviation fuel as being required to be used for aviation purposes. The proposed refined fuel language in both SB 86 and HB 158 would seem to run directly contrary to that very recent FAA guideline. FAA will be giving heightened security to aviation fuel tax issues, not less scrutiny. If the bills are not amended, and in my role as an advising attorney for this legislation, I would recommend a note that we are in likely violation of 49 U.S.C. 47107. So I think that's why they ended up with the CS. Mm-hmm. Seem like we got our hands tied, possibly.
I don't know. The DEC is here. They could maybe talk on it, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, please come forward.
Ms. Ryan.
Christine Ryan.
For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. And yes, everything said to date is accurate. We would try to pursue cost recovery like we do with all parties now. But the restrictions on the use of revenue collected at the airport, the way this federal law mandates it, it would be the amount of revenue that would be generated by taxing aviation fuel, it would be difficult for us to every year spend exactly that amount cleaning up spills or preventing spills or doing other contaminated site work at airports. So it ended up really restricting how we'd use the revenue. It's, of course, the will of the committee how you want to deal with that. But
Mr. Chair,
Sam Newman.
Just because I think this is an important issue because it's a change in the CS. So, Ms. Ryan, you just said that it would be hard to exactly say the amount of the tax collected for aviation would be the exact amount spent back on cleanup. We could say that for every one of these taxes. So do you currently try and say we're going to spend X amount on cleaning up industrial fuel spills or oil pipeline spills from the oil? Is there a delineation now of how SPAR is spent?
Mr. Chairman, no, there's not. But this specific federal law would require the accounting to do that specifically for aviation fuel, whereas we aren't under that obligation with these other funding streams.
So they would, if I could, just following up then. So you would have to record how much fuel is probably used, which you probably do now anyhow, at Department of Revenue. So you already have that information, and then that's a yes. So then you could calculate that, so it wouldn't be a lot of extra work. I mean, when we looked at a tire tax, they have to do everything from tractor tires and everything that aren't even taxed at revenue. They do extra stuff. But you already have this information in hand. I just don't understand this, and I understand, Mr. Co-Chair, that there's some federal stuff in there, but I'm confused as to why we're going to still spill response SPAR funds that we'd have to for entities that don't pay into it. And that's troubling to me. When we're now asking to tax passengers, we have 34,000 Batsu residents that have to go back and forth to Anchorage every day. We have to pay a gasoline tax. We've got other people. We have homeowners. I just called it, you know, the tax when I buy fuel oil for my home, I have to pay for that for help response. So everybody else is doing it. The oil companies are doing it. But we take one entity and we take them out, yet SPAR is still required to go back and use their funds for cleanup. I just don't understand that, Mr. Chair. Ms. Could you explain it to me why it is that way?
Mr. Chairman, I can't. This isn't my legislation, but yes, your point is I think, well taken. They are now going to be exempt, whereas everyone else is not. Is that the right thing to do? I can't answer that for you, but the bill as is with the exemption generates enough revenue to solve our shortfall. So from the department's perspective, the bill is still adequate to solve our problem with the exemption.
Mr. Chair, and I'll let others ask questions, but it takes the money from the commuters that have to go back and forth to Anchorage and homeowners to heat and fuel to cover their costs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The bill sponsor, Representative Munoz, has a statement on that subject.
As I've stated earlier in this process, for the last 3 years I've had this budget, and I was directed specifically to find a solution. Three-quarters of the spills that occur in Alaska happen with refined fuels, yet currently the program is primarily funded through a surcharge on crude oil. This is an effort to try to recognize that there are multiple entities that are responsible for spilling in our state. The federal prohibition that Representative Thompson just, or the federal language, limits how this revenue could be spent with aviation spills or aviation activity. I think the total revenue coming in from an aviation surcharge would be something around $1.3 million. Yet every year we would have to define that activity at $1.3 million to justify that activity. So it just makes the implementation difficult, and that's why we determined to exempt aviation.
I understand that, Mr. Chair, and I know that Representative Munoz is concerned about this, but still, at the airports, they're still spending state general fund dollars for their fire crews to go out and practice using foam and other retardants and everything else, buoys, to try and, you know, do spill prevention type of activities that go towards this. I just don't know why we're doing it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll let others ask questions.
Next, we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. First, a couple questions. I just want to clarify that the change in the exemption of aviation fuel, private pilot, aviation fuel to me is 100 low lead or 80 leaded. Is this aviation fuel specifically defined as jet fuel for jet transport, or does it also include 100 low lead, 80 leaded fuel?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, in working with Ledge Legal, our understanding is that it covers all.
A result, yes, that's what I figure. Okay. How would the proposed exemption of aviation fuel as defined affect the projected revenue stream? I might have heard it, but I'd like to get it reminded.
Representative Sadler, through the co-chair, Ken Alper may be able to bolster this, but our understanding is that number's right about 1.4.
It would reduce it by?
It would reduce it by. They calculated the number of gallons of aviation fuel that they brought in, and that's the rough calculation. And I know they are working on getting those exact numbers to us.
I would like to know this. Okay. My understanding of the issue is that the addition of motor fuel tax on page 5 and for example, line 2 and thereafter, is kind of a belt and braces distinction. There are currently motor fuel taxes, which are defined as motor fuel taxes, that are paid by vehicles on the ground and in the air, and that those fees are used. Aviation taxes are used for at the aviation facility as per FAA grant requirements. The other fuels are used for goes to spot. But this creates a refined fuel surtax, which is not a motor fuel tax. Am I correct in understanding that the distinction is a telling one between motor fuel tax and refined fuel surtax?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, you're absolutely correct. The language in here where it specifically delineates the motor fuel tax is so there is no confusion. Before, current statute had said taxes, and so now that there would be more than one stream coming in, they wanted to make a clear distinction between the two.
Is there any effectual distinction between the use of aviation funds for capital operating costs of airports compared to aviation facilities? Is that just a legal term of art, or is there an effective distinction between those?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'm not, that's a piece I'm not 100% certain on. I know that there was some discussion over the last couple days in, you know, being able to have airports utilize monies more efficiently, so there wouldn't be as much, my understanding is that there wouldn't be as much general fund dollars going to the airports, and that these funds would be able to offset.
One last point, and this is a comment more than a question. is that the case can be made that because the current SPAR is populated with money raised from a 4 or 5 cent per barrel tax on crude oil. Crude oil is refined in the state and elsewhere in the state and used to power jet aircraft. So in essence, revenue is being raised to pay for slow response by the stream of fuel that fuels aircraft in Alaska already. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's my understanding. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Next, we have Representative Wilson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so on the document that we were given about the top spills, Antioch Airport is like, you know, $6,800,000. So I don't know why we couldn't be collecting from airports and using to do that. But I want a better understanding on how these funds currently are utilized, because I was very surprised to find Flint Hills on here at a $4.4 million to find out that the money was used for studies, for public meetings, but not for cleanup. So how do I distinguish these numbers between what actually was used for cleaning up and what was used for other services?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. Again, Kristen Ryan, Director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. There are a variety of costs that go into those that are outlined there, and it's everything from our toxicologists we may hire to help us evaluate a cleanup level to the approval of the on-site cleanup plan at Flint Hills, like we have recently done with the refinery property. So the on-site cleanup plan has been completed, and that those costs are all included in that. So it depends on the site what those costs are. A lot of legal costs are usually included in those ones that we've provided to the committee, because all of those issues have gone to formal settlement. So the Department of Law has been heavily involved with getting any payback from those. So I can provide you a per-site explanation, and I'll need to do that, you know, outside of the committee. But if you have any specific...
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Follow-up. Well, the other part I want to understand is that when, again, questioned about the SOFA lane and North Pole, is that the department isn't doing a per se cleanup of that area because you know who the party is. But if I look at these other examples, Mr. Chair, it seems like they know who the party is as well. And so can you please better explain when a spill happens, what you do, and then how you decide whether or not you're going to actually clean the site up and then go back after the person, or that you go through making a plan for somebody else to clean it up?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. So every site is a little bit different. Contaminated sites, as you can see in the document we provided, tend to be the most expensive activities that we conduct. And each of these sites listed, we are attempting to recover costs from. We are expecting a large settlement related to the Antioch clean up. It's in our budget as a stopgap measure, that funding we're expecting from that. River Terrace, we've settled, and this is what's remaining. We put liens on people's properties frequently, and many of these sites are in that situation, so that when the property is sold at some point, we'll recover more costs, but we can't predict when that will occur. The process, so it varies by site. First, we look at the risk. Is there an exposure issue? Are people at risk for being exposed to something that may be dangerous to their health? And that drives how we're going to use our funds. And that's all documented or designated in our statutory authorities about when and how we're supposed to use our funds to protect human health and the environment. And if the risk is great, we are supposed to use our funds to do so and then go after the responsible party if they are not doing so directly immediately. But in cases where we have a responsible party and perhaps the risk is being mitigated in some way, we'll go the slower route and work it through the process before we would step up and take over.
And I've done the follow-up.
Follow-up.
Okay, so we know that these are usually done by a barrel of oil. That's how it's been done in the past for the cleanup portion of it, versus charging, you know, the people of Alaska for something that they didn't do. I mean, I'm going to be paying this, and I didn't make the spill. And if I spill something, you're going to make me clean it up. So why not go back to the barrel and keep the same system we have versus opening up a whole new tax?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. I mean, the administration has just been asking for a solution. I wouldn't say we're advocating for one or over another, but we do believe this one makes sense. Because a lot of the spillers we are unable to recover our costs from, and this is a a solution that makes sense when you look at the amount of spills we have that are related to refined fuels, and that this would be collecting that revenue from the spillers. And that we have many homes that spill. We have many, many entities that spill that we don't regulate, and that makes us difficult to recover our costs.
And follow up? So this solution to me doesn't make sense. It may make sense to you, but so why not go after the industries most likely to do the spills? Maybe there are, I mean, what is the percentage of individuals who are the ones who have these spills compared to trucking companies? But I know, like, our mines and those, they have a huge process. They already have to go through a lot of cost because of it. And this is going to cost one of the mines in our area over $100,000 a year when there's other regulation in place, and the odds of them spilling are very minute because of all the regulation that they go. So why not go and say what industry is more likely the ones that are doing this and utilizing that kind of cost versus the regular individual?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I believe in the bill packet we provided information to the sponsor that breaks down the spills by type, by who did the spilling. So you can see from that information who's spilling that we're responding to, and you can see it by product type. It varies substantially by which industries, and several are not industries. They're boats, they're trucks, they're homeowners. So their facilities are people or small businesses like dry cleaners that we don't regulate. And we really, I can't think of an efficient way that we could regulate them to recover costs up front. We do try to recover them after the fact, but as we've said several times in the record, sometimes that just is impossible and they don't have the revenue. We don't know who did the spilling, or we're locked up in long-term litigation to recover those costs, which takes years. So I would direct you to the bill packet that would give you the breakdown of spills for the last 5 years by industry.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think this is an easier way of getting the money, and that's out of, you know, the people who heat our home. And it really bothers me that, you know, we're already paying high heating costs in Fairbanks. Now we're going to add this to it as well. So those others who are paying high heating costs, it's going to go on to our heating fuel. But my bigger concern than even the penny taxes is that it appears that this fund is used to actually clean up a piece of property. And I am not convinced that that's what it's used for. I think it's used for a whole lot of other things like studies and litigation, but I don't know how much of this money is actually going to cleaning up the spill from the beginning to the end, which is what it sounds like it is. So I thank you.
I would like, before we move on too far, have David Teal please come up and explain to us a little bit about the aviation fuel exemption. Ms. Ryan, we probably will have you come back eventually too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we have Mr. Teal kind of describe the discrepancies between the motor fuel tax and refined fuel surcharge and why we're exempting this and how this process works?
For the record, I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. There are perhaps a couple things I could help clarify. Mr. Chairman, you read from the federal regulations, and there you noted that they said capital or operating. The number here, or the language here, said aviation facilities, meaning that you could spend at facilities, but oftentimes we think of facilities as being a building, an infrastructure thing. Money is allowed to be spent for both capital and operating. That change was simply to comply with the way the federal regs are written. Now, the federal grant requirements say that aviation fuel taxes, proceeds, any tax that you levy on them can be spent only for those airport facilities, capital or operating costs. So we have a little problem here. If you tried to send the aviation tax proceeds or the surcharge proceeds over to DEC, they would have to do all the accounting for this, and you would end up with dedicated revenue, the aviation surcharge, inside the oil and hazardous fund, which is not a dedicated fund. We don't like that. We don't even know how to classify a fund that has dedicated revenue inside a fund that's not dedicated. It's mixed. So we thought it best not to send the money to oil and hazardous fund at all. The second problem there is that it's not just a matter of spending it on airports. There are three airport systems in Alaska, the international airports, and then the other state-owned, well, you might just call them rural airports, and then the eight municipally-owned airports. Each of those has to get its share back. So DEC would now have to account for three different outflows, not airport by airport, but system by system. And then you look at the international airports, which have on-site spill response capabilities, so that if there were a spill, they would clean it up themselves, meaning that SPAR wouldn't have the money or wouldn't need to spend money responding to a spill at an international airport. Well, where is the bulk of fuel tax or surcharge generated? It's where the big sales are at those international airports. So we would be sending aviation surcharge to SPAR and having someone have a difficult time spending that money. So the decision was that you could levy a surcharge, not send it to SPAR or to Oil and Hazardous Fund. That's easy, but you could have the surcharge, and then the surcharge would simply accumulate in the special aviation account. Someone apparently made the decision that this bill is specifically to address SPAR and their problems, not to do a general overhaul of motor fuel taxes. And if it wasn't going to go to SPAR or oil and hazardous, then the surcharge should be dropped from the bill. So I think, does that explain that the surcharge, the motor fuel tax, is dedicated, and putting it in DEC just creates a big problem?
We do have questions from Representative Kawasaki and Guerra. We do have one member in the audience for public testimony. We'd like to make sure that because they're in Juneau today that they get an opportunity for that. So I guess Representative Kawasaki, can yes. you hold your question? Uh-huh. Representative Kawasaki?
You want me to hold it? Sure.
If you could, so we can get public testimony allowed for the people that are in the audience. And we won't cut off public testimony, but while they're here, to make sure that they're here, and then we'll go back and ask your questions if we could. So we can just excuse us. I want to make sure we allow for the public testimony. Ms. Miardi?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. We are the professional trade association whose mission is to foster the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry in Alaska for the benefit of all Alaskans. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this bill. AOGA represents the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, transporters, and marketers in Alaska. And with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, this is important for my testimony. Our current members include Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Apache Corporation, BP, Kalis, Chevron, Eni Petroleum, ExxonMobil, Hillcorp, Petrostar, Repsol, Shell, Statoil, DeSoro, and XTO Energy. And because this legislation is a tax-related matter, this testimony has the unanimous consent from all of these companies, producers and refiners alike, which is important and something I've worked with the bill sponsor on. As a bit of history, Alaska has had some sort of oil spill cleanup fund in place since 1976, when the state created the Coastal Protection Fund during the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, or TAPS. Over time, the fund morphed into the oil spill mitigation account, then the oil spill hazardous account, and then in 1986 into what it is today,
the Oil and Hazardous Substance Prevention and Release Response Fund. So we just keep adding words. But it is commonly referred to as the 470 Fund, a reference to the bill that created it in 1986. The revenue generated, as we've talked about, would be deposited into the prevention account of this fund. In addition to the hundreds of millions of dollars invested each year by the industry in Alaska to prevent, prepare, and respond to the release of hazardous substances, AOGA has long supported fair and equitable efforts to ensure the state of Alaska is also financially prepared. To date, the state has collected a surcharge only on the oil and gas industry, as we've talked about. If an incident occurs, the oil and gas industry also repays costs associated with the response, as do some other regulated industries. Still, the oil and gas industry is the only industry that has been assessed a specific surcharge or tax to pay for the purposes of this fund, even though the state utilizes the fund for a variety of other industries and individual Alaskans. To date, the oil and gas industry has contributed more than $350 million through this surcharge for the 470 Fund. We've been engaged in the policy decisions surrounding this fund since its inception. And I'd just like to note that in 1994, we supported the legislation to split the initial surcharge into two separate accounts, and we didn't oppose the modifications made in 2006. Despite the stated purpose of cleaning up and preventing spills, previous administrations and legislatures allowed for the fund to be used for non-spill projects such as campgrounds, state airports, tank farm remediation, privately owned greenhouses, and new ferries. I do believe DEC and this legislature should be commended because it appears these types of expenditures are no longer being appropriated from the fund, but the corpus of the fund may have been unnecessarily reduced during those years when these type of appropriations were authorized. You've heard previous testimony about what our spills account for in the DEC annual reports, but it is also important to note that the oil and gas industry invests hundreds of millions of dollars every year to have a robust response capability in the event of an industry-related spill occurs. We are required by federal and state regulations to have current contingency plans in place, have spill response equipment available, and exercise both the plan and the equipment on a regular basis. In addition, the companies belong to not-for-profit response cooperatives such as the Cook Inlet Spill Prevention and Response, Alaska Clean Seas, and the Prince William Sound Advisory Group. AOGA endorses the same position as the oil and gas transition team from the Walker Mulott administration, which advocated for the state to utilize other revenue sources before increasing the surcharge on the oil and gas industry. House Bill 158, as Representative Munoz has stated, does broaden the contributing efforts of others that use the fund services. Additionally, like the letter you have from the Council of Alaska Producers, AOGA advocates for DEC to continue to identify efficiencies internally. And to that end, AOGA has identified suggestions for DEC's consideration, and we will work with the state to further identify cost reductions without diminishing the state's strong oversight and regulation of the industry. We also encourage the state to adopt other policies to assist the state in recovering costs from other users who are not currently reimbursing the state after a response. In fiscal year 14, DEC billed more than $3 million to various industries and recovered only one-third of that amount. To strengthen the state of Alaska's oil spill preparedness and response, there must be an effort to recover more than 30% of the state spending. So in closing, co-chairs, AOGA is not opposed to this piece of legislation. It does broaden the contributions of others that use the fund services without having an overly adverse impact on our member companies. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to address any questions that you or members of the committee might have.
Representative Newman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Miorti, you talked about some in the past where there's been uses which probably didn't fall within the sideboards typically designated for or recognized what this fire program should be, cleaned up fire camps and things like that. And I don't, you know, it's not my intention to make changes today to this bill, but maybe a suggestion, Mr. Chair, is to work with the chair, the carrier of the bill, Representative Munoz, to define the sideboards, because you're not the only entity that I've heard about some reform that needs to happen with how these funds are used. There's other two or three other entities that I've heard from also that have the same concerns you are, and maybe we should get those into statute. This administration seems to be cognizant on the proper use of the funds and how they should be funds, but again, maybe as this bill moves down the path, we should recognize that and put the sideboards in legislation that would draft it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Moriarty. would your this is hot. They're hot today. Would your member companies, would this impact them in any way? Will they be in some way, shape, or form paying this in some capacity? And do you have an idea of how much that would be?
Representative Pruitt, through the co-chairs, yes, they'll be impacted because it will increase the cost of the fuels that they used in their operations, because the distributors are going to pass those costs on. We don't know yet what that financial impact will be, but we assess that it's not an overly adverse impact, because everybody is going to have to pay a little bit more, all industries that use refined products.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Moriarty, over the years, people have tried to do 2 cent per barrel increases, and had we done those back in 2008, this fund would be solvent, and your industry has opposed those, so now we're stuck with where we are right now. And so I take it your position is that inflation-proofing what the oil companies pay, 5 cents per barrel, that hasn't been inflation-proof since 1989. It's been 5 cents for the last 25 years. That's not okay with your industry, but charging consumers is the way you want to go?
Representative Guerra, through the co-chairs, our position has been, before you increase the surcharge on us, whether it's for inflation-proofing or not, that other industries that utilize this fund should contribute in some manner. How the legislature chooses to do that, that is completely up to you. But our position has been that we have been the only contributors to this fund since its inception, but we're not the only industry that DEC utilizes those funds for.
The chair.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
Yeah. Thank you. And I could appreciate that. Other industries that are responsible. There was some testimony the other day that just for response to spills, 20%, 2% of that has been for mines, 7% has been for marines. But let me be clear, we need a solution, and I'm not going to block any solution. I mean, there needs to be some solution. If I like it, I'll vote for it on the House floor. If I don't, I won't. But this bill doesn't share it among the other industries. I mean, it's going to people who have nothing to do with spills, like, you know, it's not a huge amount of money, right? It's a cent. It's 1 cent per gallon. I mean, let's be honest. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's also not. You say you want to share it with the other industries, but the bill doesn't share it with the other industries. So, do you have a suggestion on how that could happen?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, again, it's not our position to try to determine how other industries or individuals, because individuals are some of the cause of the spills as well.
Tiny though, right?
You know, that's something you'll have to get from DEC. But that's never been our position to get into who or how the state broadens the fund. We've just advocated that the fund should be broadened besides our industry.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But don't you also pass it off? So if we made it 10 cents a barrel, don't you pass that tax off to somebody else as well?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we don't pass off our production tax or our property tax or any other tax. So it's not like we're passing it off to a distributor.
it's not as clean as a pass-through that a distributor might have at a gas station. Because we don't pass, Representative Wilson through the chair, we can't pass on all of our taxes onto a consumer. It doesn't work that way.
Okay. I'll just think about that one.
Any further questions of Kara Mariotti? Good to see you.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anybody else in the room that'd like to testify? I saw William Cummings was on the list. I didn't know if he wanted to come up and testify or not.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you for being here. Is there anybody online? There's nobody online. Okay, so no further questions. I'll close. Yeah, we got. I'll come back to them. No further questions. I will close public testimony. And now we'll go to a couple of more committee members. Representative Guerra had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question. Some questions for Ms. Ryan. She handed me a note, but I can't really read it. She was trying to respond to my questions from the last committee. So, and just for the committee's understanding, my question to her was for the prevention fund. That's the 4 cent fund. What are the big cost drivers for that? I just wanted to know what the biggest ones were, so maybe I could come up with some sort of rational way to address that through this bill. I'm not sure that I can. So, Ms. Ryan, you handed me like six types of spill prevention costs that DEC pays for and then uses the spill prevention fund for. One was there are 50 crude oil-related oil spill prevention or contingency plans. Is that correct?
Correct.
And is that the? Did you put them in order because that's the most expensive one, or you just put them in? You just wrote them down. Just wrote them down. Okay. And is the crude oil prevention plan the contingency planning? Is that the most expensive part for the prevention fund? Yes.
Yes, on the record. Kristen Ryan, Director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. Representative Gary, would you like me to describe what I provided you for the whole committee?
Yeah. I mean, this is it.
I apologize for the format. I can provide them in writing formally after the hearing. The request came in just a few minutes before the hearing. So Representative Guerra was asking for information about prevention activities because we do not, that is part of the cost of what we do is the prevention work. So I provided him some statistics about some of the prevention work we do. The primary prevention activity is contingency plans. Those are plans that by statute are required of certain operators. All oil and gas exploration and production activity would require a contingency plan. This explains how they'll prevent a spill from occurring. What activities are they doing to prevent them, like corrosion detection in pipelines, for example. And then also a big part of them is what you will do when a spill occurs. What is your contingencies for addressing a spill when that occurs? So we have 50 contingency plans related to oil exploration and production right now that are approved. And then we have about another, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me like I gave you, but about 580 related to refined fuel. So that's boats, vessels, shipping refined fuel around the state. It's tank farms, larger tank farms. We don't regulate the smaller ones. Mainly it's boats and tank farms that are related to refined fuel. And then the second prevention-related work that we can do are drills and exercises where we test the industry to make sure they can adequately respond when they occur. These are very expensive for us and industry. They spend a lot of money, as Kara has already mentioned, practicing response to make sure they can do it right when they need to. And we have legal obligations on them to do that, and we watch them do those things. We do 21 drills. Last year we did 21 drills and exercises related to the oil and gas industry, and we did 3 for refined fuel. You can see we put a little more emphasis on the oil industry because there's more activity associated with cleaning up oil than refined fuels, so that's where we spend most of our time practicing. And then finally, our third prevention activity is related to financial responsibility, and that's where we verify companies have the financial capacity to clean up a spill if it occurs. Again, this is limited to the industries that we regulate, the larger entities. This does not get down to the smaller
facilities or homes that we don't regulate. And then finally, our fourth prevention activity is inspections and verifying that people have the prevention measures in place that their plans say they do. So that is what I provided Representative Guerra.
Through the chair.
Another question, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So on checking to see if companies are able to pay, you listed 414 financial responsibility checks. I'll just confirm if that's accurate. And then 869 refined fuel financial responsibility checks. Is that right?
That is correct.
And is that now that you've given us that list from crude oil prevention, spill prevention plans to drills to see if potential oil spillers can satisfy the plans that they've written down, and then same thing for refineries and refinery-related businesses, is that the bulk of the cost, what you listed today, is that the bulk of the cost for the spill prevention plan or for the spill prevention side of your agency?
Yes, Representative Guerra, through the chair, that covers the bulk of our expenses related to the prevention of spills. Yes.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Pardon?
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And next we have Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. I have a question for Kristen Ryan and then a question on the federal aviation issue that we've been talking about. But on the We have those graphs, the ones that show the volume spilled, product type, facility type, contaminated sites, contaminant type. So it's broken down like that. But we know that oil spills tend to cost more as far as remediation and cleanup goes. I'm wondering if there's a graph that shows who the where the largest cost drivers are, rather than where the volumes are, because there's probably, like I know in the first page it talks about contaminated sites, 4% of those contaminated sites are explosives and munitions, which seem fairly easy to clean up, versus waste oil might be more difficult to clean up and cost more. Is there anything that shows that, because we're trying to figure out the cost drivers and try and attach that to the people who should be the most responsible party?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I don't have the specific information you're requesting, but what I can tell you from my experience is, yes, oil spills are more expensive to clean up than a refined fuel spill, but we regulate the oil industry so that they have the capacity to respond to those spills, and we don't go that far with all the refined fuel carriers. So when you're asking about what cost drivers are, in reality, the oil industry so far we're recovering our costs from those large expensive events based on our laws. It's the smaller entities that we can't recover our costs from that are why the account is unable to be 100% sustainable through cost recovery.
And then follow up,
Representative
Just
Kawasaki.
A quick follow up. We have the April 1 document from the Division of Revenue, and it describes some of the groups that'll be either covered through the surcharge or exempted under this. And so there's highway use, gasoline basically will not be exempted, utilities and power plants will not be exempted, foreign flights will, federal, state, local governments won't, heating oil, so homeowners will. Are those the accurate groups, I mean, most appropriately to place the burden on for the response, or I guess in some form or fashion, in your opinion?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I'm not sure I completely understand. That's just the way the bill is written. This was, and maybe Director Alper can provide a better response than me, but this is just the way the exemptions are. This does not reflect the CS, by the way, which now would include the aviation exemption, so that should be added to this list. But that was their calculations based on fuel use by industry. If you're asking me, can I correlate that with spill data, not directly, but you can see from our graph, we do provide the breakdown of spills generally by how we categorize them, and you can see the connections.
Okay.
And then I have a question for the on the aviation thing, I think, still.
Of Mr. Alper or
who? It could be Ken. Yeah, Ken's fine, I guess. Or
Ryan, thank you very much, I guess.
Yeah.
Just
pardon?
Just really quickly on the aviation one, when the description Dave Teal was there, is it simply?
Teal, would you come back up then?
Is it simply an issue of accounting? I mean, it can be done. The memo from the 31st, says that we'll get back to you on it in response to Representative Pruitt's question. The next one filed says that they are in fact the surcharge could in fact be collected. I mean, I guess that's what the words say, generally. So is it just a matter of sequestering the funds separately in the spill account? Is it an accounting issue, or is it what's the issue, I guess? Why is it a problem?
Again, David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance, Representative Kawasaki through the chair. It's both. You've got the accounting issues of handling a dedicated fund, and it will be classified as dedicated because there's a federal requirement that it be limited to airport spending. The same document that the chairman read from said there's a problem trying to spend that airport or the aviation tax proceeds on spill recovery. Okay, there's a legal problem there. There's the accounting problem because if we were to send money over there, then you've got to separately account for the three different airport systems, and you've got this dedicated fund inside another fund. So there are a number of problems, all of which say simplify the bill, exempt aviation fuel from the tax because we can't guarantee that we would be spending it the way the federal government demands that we spend it.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
Let me get this straight. So, the big airports, Fairbanks and Anchorage, would be paying the bulk of this perhaps surcharge if it weren't exempted in the bill. And could that money be used for other airports outside of Fairbanks and Anchorage?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, no. Is a simple answer to that. International airport money stays where it is, the Muni money has to stay where it is, and then the rural airport system gets its money.
Okay, now I get it. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from committee members? Representative Newman.
I had a question for Ms. Ryan.
Ms. Ryan, please come back. Thank you, Mr. Teal.
Ping pong. Ms. Ryan. How often do you know if you had to respond to a fuel spill from a vehicle?
For the record, Kristen Ryan, Director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. I'm going to go to the chart that was in your bill packet because vehicle is listed. About 2% of the time we're responding to spills related to vehicles, according to our spill data.
Okay. Follow up.
Clarify that. Is that an individual spill? I'm assuming at a gas station that would be tied to a vehicle. So, and almost get gas stations are equipped with an emergency button, a red button, that shuts off the fuels, and then gas stations now are also required to have absorbents and buoys available for spill response and double wall holding tanks and monitors with sniffers for fuel leaks and a lot of safety equipment to make sure that there's no leaks with the tanks and around holding stations and stuff like that for a vehicle. So if a vehicle might be because the automatic shutoff didn't work, I guess there also all pumps have automatic shutoffs when the tank is full. So it's still 2% of your money goes towards. I'm just trying to think of the average guy who's driving a car. Do you have to go clean up a fuel spill because of them?
Mr. Chairman, the
when we look at spills by vehicles, I mean, the one that's most obvious to me is the truck rollovers. Now, that's not your average guy driving his truck, but it's a significant issue that we've seen an increasing need to respond to. In fact, we've had several this year, more than last year. So for me to break down, I can go back to look at my data to see if I can get actual, you know, private vehicle information. I'm not sure I'll be able to, but I can try.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious because that's a large part of the tax, and I just wondered.
You know, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know, when have these funds been audited last? Are they audited on a regular basis, or when was the last time?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it was before my tenure as the director of this division, but it's been recently. It's been within the last 5 years. I think they completed one right in FY 12 or 13. I can get that for you. It's been audited several times in the past 10 years, I think two or three times.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Kristen, I'm sorry to drag you through this again. If it's been answered already, I apologize. But I'm looking at some of the backup, the pie charts you have showing the breakout of what's spilled and how much and so forth. Got a couple of questions for you. First, we have active contaminated sites by contaminant type. Can you define what is an active contaminated site? Are those?
Representative Sadler, through the chair. So those are a site where we have not closed it. We there's still a need to clean up contamination, or there are two things. One, where they're actively cleaning up the contamination, or two, where we've agreed to leave the contamination in the ground and allow it to naturally dissipate. So that requires monitoring to ensure that it's, one, not migrating, and two, that it is degrading, that it's dropping in the levels. If the levels get below our cleanup level standards and regulation, then we would close it. We'd say, okay, you're done. There's no longer a risk. You have no longer left contamination in the ground that's above our cleanup level. But we have a lot of sites where there is an active remediation occurring. They're above our cleanup level, but we're allowing it to you know, nature to take care of it, or they may be actually doing active, you know, pump and treats or something that takes years to slowly dissolve the contaminant.
Yeah, I think several members are trying to, or maybe have been trying to, just get our heads around how much responsibility is it fair to apportion to those who would pay the fuel tax surcharge. And kind of probing through the next sheet of slides here, we have more instructive from fiscal year 10 to 14, the more long-term. We have the volume released by product, overall, the things you respond to, diesel fuel and gasoline is about 29%, and we've exempted aviation fuel in the version we got before. So, yeah, maybe 29-30% is by volume. And then among refined products, which is diesel and gasoline, is about 72%. Brief question, kerosene, engine lube oil, hydraulic oil, are those considered refined products and subject to this surcharge? So is engine lube oil, hydraulic fluid, kerosene subject to the refined fuel surcharge?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I do not believe so, but I would have to defer to the Department of Revenue to see how they classify kerosene and lube, and oil and lube oil. I don't believe so, but I would have to defer.
Okay. They're small portions of the pie. So my overall take is that of all products spilled, diesel and gas are about a third, and that diesel is about 60% of the refined products spilled. Okay.
It is 3:45 already, and I was planning on running it until just 4 p.m. I don't see how we're going to have enough time to get HB 41 in. I really apologize to the sponsor, Representative Tilton, and probably we're going to be a little bit more on this one, so I doubt if we're going to get to your bill yet today. So I appreciate you being here and being patient and waiting. I'm going to continue on with this bill, though. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ryan, I just want to see. There are times where the state enforces things and we get our enforcement costs back. So antitrust, consumer cases, we get our full enforcement costs back in some of those. And so, but my understanding, I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong, but when you have to go after a responsible party, do you get your full enforcement costs back, or do you only get, like, in most lawsuits, you only get 20% of your litigation fees back, and you eat the other 80%. So is this one of these areas where you get your full enforcement costs back, or you only get part of your enforcement costs back, and you basically lose money on enforcing?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, all situations are different. We initiate cost recovery. The first step is in the division where we send out letters to potentially responsible parties. If we are unsuccessful, then we refer it to departmental law and it becomes a formal cost recovery matter. And if it's a large site, they tend to settle out of court, and it's rare we get all our costs recovered, yes. But it varies by site how much we recover.
Mr. Chair, just to be more specific, in some litigation, when you get to the litigation phase, most litigants only get 20% of their legal costs back when they win a case.
Mm-hmm.
But in some areas, like antitrust or some consumer protection areas, you actually get 100% of your litigation costs back from the responsible party, so you don't lose money on enforcing the law. Do you know which one of those applies to your efforts?
Representative Guerra, I'm going to have to get back to you to be sure on that one. It's changed in the last couple of years, and I can't recall if we are successful in winning how much of legal fees are allocated. We don't get 100%. I know that, but I don't know the percentage how high we can go to recover legal fees.
All right, thanks.
All right. Is there further discussion or comment or questions by the committee members? Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. One more. So, I'm going to give you an example of a current site, and I'm curious how it's paid for. There's the site where in Anchorage, where the new Walmart over in Muldoon and DeBar is. Prior to the Walmart, there was a construction company. Come to find out, of course, I remember as a kid, I'd watch them pile their tires in huge piles and light them on fire. I remember the black smoke going all over the place, which you could never do now. Well, there were other things that they did as well, including backing up the back-end loaders to a big pit and just unscrewing it and letting the oil come out. That has gotten into the water table there. And it has since that time frame, it has migrated. Walmart purchased that property from the now deceased Mr. Miller, and they have mitigated, but yet mitigation required. I mean, there's the contamination has moved into areas around, including the church that's right next to it and whatnot. Who pays for the monitoring that goes on there? And if we've got to have a regulatory role in that in some capacity. If we do, are we compensated for our efforts, or does that come from the fund here to deal with our efforts in regulating who is monitoring that?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I'm familiar with the site you're bringing up, but I not enough to give you the specific answer to that site. I can give you a generic answer now and give you
that
specifics
works.
Later. So it depends again on the site and the risks exposed. So that in that site, I do know there was these fumes that were seeping up into this church and other neighboring properties. So there was a risk issue that we were very concerned about. And so I know we did some of the initial sampling to verify that those fumes were carcinogenic and needed to be addressed. But if there's a responsible party, obviously our legal mandate is to pursue them, but in situations where they don't exist, if there is a health risk, we're going to use our funds to address it and again try to find responsible parties that go way back. I mean, that ends up being a chase that Department of Law performs for us when they seek out previous responsible parties that have left the state or gone elsewhere.
Follow up. So in this case, and I recognize, I think this is just an example of situations that are throughout, but it has been purchased by, in this case, it's Walmart that's purchased that, and it's obviously migrated beyond their ownership. In a situation like that, they are now the new owner. Is it their responsibility? I mean, it almost seems like, I mean, they came in and doubled the offer on that land that was previously on there. Once they got into it, they apparently understood, because they ended up, it was a $20+ million just to purchase and then reclaim before they started building their facility there. Is Walmart the responsible party that we go after now, or is there a statute of limitations that prevents us from going after them as the new owner? In this case, a very large commercial owner, not always going to be the case, that we can seek the monies for our role in monitoring this.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I believe one of my attorneys is online, but and so I'm going to walk lightly. But yes, the way the statutes are written, the current owner is a responsible party, even if they did not cause the contamination. I mean, we are legally obligated to pursue them as the owner of contaminated property. Now, in most situations, they turn around and go after the true responsible party that caused the contamination, so it starts this chain reaction. But my understanding of our statutes is that we are required to go after the current owner first, even if they weren't the causer of the contamination.
And last question, Mr. Chair. And I wasn't trying to focus on this, but this is just an example I think that spreads out.
Yeah.
But how many cases are out there where it almost seems like, yeah, we try to go after them, but maybe we don't? At what point do we stop, we give up, say we're not doing it, and this money then goes into I think one of the concerns that there's a historical reference, and we talked a little bit earlier about historical reference in terms of the fund itself. There's concern about, is it being utilized correctly? Are we working on getting the money that we're owed, et cetera? So at what point in time do we determine we're not going to go after that, and then it switches to now the fund is going to start paying for that, and it becomes a cost that the state is bearing?
Representative Pruitt, to the chair, that's it's something that we rely on Department of Law to make that determination. That really is their call to tell us if we have a legal ability to recover any funds. So again, I need to defer to them, but I will tell you we are working on regulations to clarify what criteria would be considered for when cost recovery should be pursued and when it shouldn't be. Again, in concert with Department of Law, so that we can provide that, I guess, more information to people to understand how and when we make those, Department of Law makes those decisions.
Last question based on one of our answers. Is regulation enough, or do you need statutes to assist you in making sure that we have as much, the state is not held, for lack of a better term, hostage to some of these scenarios where we are stepping in to take care of the problem?
Representative Pritchett, I don't know. I'll have to get back to you on if Department of Law feels we need some statutory help there. I'm not aware of any off the top of my head.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
15+ years ago, I was involved in the purchase of some property that was contaminated, and it was apparently contaminated from back in the 50s and 60s. Come to find out, insurance companies back in those days didn't have clauses in there where they wouldn't be responsible for environmental cleanups. It went clear back to those old insurance companies, three owners prior, and there was money collected to help pay for monitoring wells and things going clear back that far. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Moriarty talked about that there were other options that she was speaking to you about that besides this one. Could you share what those are?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the increasing the surcharge has been an option. The existing surcharge on oil has been an option that's been discussed since before my involvement in this activity. So I think that was the main other idea, other than a refined fuel option that was being considered.
Follow-up?
So, follow-up, Representative Wilson.
But the part that I kind of caught on is what might be able to be done so that there's more than a 30% recovery, if there's things that can be done, whether that's what you're referring to on regulation or possible statute, because it seems like, you know, this might be a temporary revenue issue because you're out there still waiting for recovery. But what if those numbers increase to 50 to 60, 70% because they were tighter? you know, what can you do to make that solution as part of this?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, so I'm not sure I understand the question, but you're wondering how we can improve cost recovery efforts. I think the regulations are a good first step. I have done a variety of things in the division to improve cost recovery since I've started. I have automated the billing, which before was done manually, and there were potentially errors involved when you do anything manually. So I'm trying to improve the efficiency of cost recovery. They now go out monthly rather than occasionally when there's a need. So when people get a monthly bill, they're more likely to pay than when they get one every 6 months, for example. Just simple things like that that we're expecting to see some improvements on. We're also connecting our time tracking data with cost recovery, and we've established, so for example, a spill responder may get a phone call that they think there's a sheen and they need some help. So we can't really bill that person for the 15 minutes of technical assistance we provide. That really would be inefficient. So we've agreed that, okay, if you go out to a site and you respond, that's when we should kick in cost recovery. Or if you spend more than 5 hours, I think, or is it four, on the phone, then we need to kick in cost recovery. We need to start billing them. So there's certain things like that that we were implementing to try to improve our efforts to recover our costs that I think we're going to see benefits from soon.
And a follow-up, sir?
Follow-up.
So I noticed in the information that you that looks like that ANIAC that will have $5 million put back in as recovery, plus with some of the efficiencies you just talked about, what will the actual shortfall do you think it is with the extra recovery of dollars and the $5 million that should be coming in for that? What's it? And I know it's an approximate because you can't know what's going to come upon. Would the shortfall be this next year if that $5 million comes in?
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair. The timing of that has been a problem. You know, we anticipated it. It's the reason we're in the crisis. In FY16, we anticipated that funding would be available. And the way the accounting systems work, the money is allocated to the fund, and then it's appropriated to the prevention account. So there's a year lag when the money actually comes into the state system and before we can access it. So our estimates right now in FY16, we will be roughly around $7 million short in FY16 going forward. Now, with the ANIAC settlement, that means we'll have a decrease perhaps in 17 of $5 million. But historically, when large settlements have come in, they sit in the account. And it's the legislature that appropriates my annual operating budget. That doesn't change. As these settlements come in, they just sit in the account and are available for appropriations in the future. So there isn't that $5 million would offset, so there may be a buildup in the account for a year of $5 million. That's available in future years, or the legislature could choose to reappropriate for something else. It's a fund source that the legislature appropriates.
I understand you correctly. You're saying that some of the shortfall could be is because as settlements have come in, they have not necessarily come back to the fund. They've come back to the general fund. And so, I mean, is that correct?
No, Representative Wilson. They go into the special fund, and that we only draw our portion every year. So they stay in the fund. As production has declined and the surcharge is only generating about half of what we need right now based on production rates, we have been living off those settlements that have been built up in the fund. So they're all gone now. Because we anticipated ANIAC to be available in 16, but it wasn't, now we're sort of in this crisis mode because the settlement just did not occur in time.
And just the last question then. So,
Wilson.
So like I said, let's assume the efficiencies happen and the sunset and all the rest, and why would you not sunset this bill then so that in case, let's say, things turn around and these things start collecting and you may not necessarily need the money anymore, why not a sunset so that it could be audited, checked to see if this is necessary any longer?
Representative Wilson, I don't know if I can really answer that. That's a decision you could make. But as always, the legislature appropriates these funds, not maybe within your power to decide what to do with them if they came in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, at this time I'd entertain a motion to move the CS for HB 158 version I from committee. You want to do it? You got it?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move CS for House Bill 158, version I, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
And I object.
And if I could also then say, inclusive of a new physical note from revenue that will be forthcoming and attached to the bill to reflect the changes in the CS.
Mr. Chair, I object.
There is an objection. Okay, Clerk, call the roll.
Chair, just
you want to speak on your objection?
Yeah, I would. I'm sensitive to that there may be a shortfall in this, but maybe I'm a little bit more sensitive because of the area that I come from and what I've seen happen with this response money, and it's, you know, not cleanup money, and I want to make sure it's clear that this, that these funds are not necessarily used to clean up an area, and that's what it does sound like. I think there are other options that are still out there that we're not looking at. I don't think we're recouping what we are supposed to be recouping and to take. And I know this may sound silly that it's only a penny, but it's not just only a penny. It's going back to starting a taxation on everyone who may be doing the right things. And I'm not just talking about individuals. I'm talking mining. I'm talking industries. You've got great industries out there who are doing a lot on regulation, making sure they're okay, and we're going to make them pay for things that others have done who are not being as careful, who might not need to be as careful either, because now we're going to have a fund to pay out that we don't necessarily even recoup. And I can't ask my constituents, when this, especially on the heating oil portion of it, you know, while we sit here continuously waiting for gas that others have, or hydro and more affordable energy, we're going to add to their costs that they have. You know, and until I feel like we've overturned every rock and looked at others, and you know, this is nothing against the maker of this bill. This is not an easy thing. She's had, you know, DEC, which, you know, trying to figure this out, but this, we're just not there yet. You know, we still have other things we need to look at. There's a lot of questions that were brought up today that we don't have answers. I had asked for a meeting from DEC for a while now so that I could understand better, even on our issue, where that money was spent. I mean, it's $4 million. Where did that money go when none of it went to cleaning up the area that's contaminated, and this is supposed to be for spills? So, you know, we're spilling. I heard it was on studies. It was on meetings for the constituents. It was to have other things done. That's not a cleanup. A cleanup to me is to make an area to where they don't have the contamination anymore, not where somebody else thinks it's safe. And so, you know, I just cannot support this. I don't normally do this on a vote on a bill like this, and I've tried to make it clear that I wasn't ready for this yet, so I just want to make sure I put that on record.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I recognize the difficulty the sponsor's had. She's tried to do everything to make this fund solvent. I have, others have. I think a number of people in this building have tried, and there's been opposition, frankly, from the oil industry says they don't want to pay for all of this, so they've the bills to increase the per-barrel charge by 2 cents, which would have made this solvent years ago, have all failed. And so I get what the sponsor is saying. If she proposes a per-barrel charge, even to inflation-proof the charge, from over the last 25 years it hasn't been inflation-proofed, I think she knows she's not going to be able to get the bill passed. So I sympathize with that. And I also sympathize with the difficulty of doing what Representative Wilson mentioned, which is figure out which industries are the most responsible and figure out how to charge them. It's not easy. If it was easy, I would have come in here. I would have spoken to the sponsor. And so I don't feel like I can hold up a bill just because I haven't been able to figure out the best solution. But you know, I'm going to vote yes to let this out of committee. I'm going to consider it before it hits the floor. My yes vote in letting it out of committee is a recognition that I haven't been able to figure out a better or the perfect way to do this. And I can't hold up a bill if I can't do my job to figure out the best way to do this. So I may be a no on the floor or maybe a yes, but I don't want to hold this up. I would ask the sponsor to consider, and we'll look into it. It's our job to research it, but if this is one of those areas where the state's not getting its full enforcement costs back and we're losing money by enforcing, by following up and successfully recovering for a spill, this should be one of those areas where we get our full costs back. So we'll look into that. We'll model it after other states' statutes that we have if that's the case. With that, that's all I have to say.
Sandy Sadler.
Thank you. Be brief. I certainly don't want to overburden the drivers around Alaska. I come from a commuter district, too, and I certainly don't want to excessively impose additional fees on them. But it's clear that Alaskans do value a responsible, effective oil spill response prevention capability. We also demand that it be effective and cost-efficient, and I've got evidence in the record that indicates that they've done a lot to tighten down the hatches and spend less and shed missions and shed personnel and positions. There is still, however, a need to maintain that capability that is not being met by the current financing structure. So if this isn't the solution, then the solution is general fund money, which in essence is going to mean CBR money. Unless a better solution comes up before the floor, I've got to vote to let this go forward. I think they're doing a good effort at trying to apportion the cost of spill response to users. I think jamming more in the oil industry is not appropriate. It might be an imperfect way to apportion those costs, but it is an effort in that direction. So in that spirit, and knowing the frustration of years trying to get something done and just not wanting to dip further into savings, I'll let this go forward as well.
Representative Newman.
Hey, Mr. Chair, and I've already talked to Representative Munoz, and she's done a yeoman job of trying to – I asked her to try and find a solution for this, and she's done a very good job of trying to do that. But it's the distribution part that I have to think of the 34,000 Manson residents who have to drive 100-plus miles every day, back and forth every day to go to work, just so that they can feed their families. And I have to respect what they would think about this. And I just don't think that they could support another tax on top of what they're doing right now. You know, I've let the sponsor know my concerns there. I cannot, with a clear conscience, vote a yes on this bill to move it out of the committee because of that. And I've made that clear to the sponsor prior to this. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel I must speak on this, especially based on the decision that I have in allowing it to move out. I've sat on the subcommittee for DEC before. And we knew that this was coming, and unfortunately, it's a long time coming, this challenge, and we haven't been able to find the solution to make it happen. We've talked about per barrel surcharges, which was again a continued. In this case, we were going to loop that onto one industry. When it was clear in the discussions that we had when I sat on the subcommittee that these were coming from more than just that industry. We talked about the marine. We talked about the underground storage, fuel storage, and talked about many different aspects of the challenges that they faced. And I can't think of another way to make the, for lack of a better term, guilty parties pay. I've spent time myself on the committee trying to find other ways to make this work. I can't figure it out. But the thing is we're going to have to pay for this. It's going to come from general fund or CBR or something. We've got to pay for it. And if we've got to pay for it, and instead of push this off again. We've had meetings in this very room about having to go to our constituents potentially on one of several different methods of paying for state government. And we can either allow this to continue and not do anything and perpetuate the use of general fund that we don't have, or we can try to make this as fair as we can come up with. And I myself, and there may be something out there that I've missed, but I can't come up with another way to make this fair. Mines that spill, and there is some spill that go on, and they've indicated that, they'll be party to it. We've heard from the Council of Producers that they're not objecting to it. They recognize the role that they play.
marine fuel, and of course there's a substantial amount. They're going to participate in this. But I will say that the one thing that really bothers me, and we have a new director, she's been there for a year and a half, is that now that we're deciding to go to the people to pay for this, that does not mean that this is a carte blanche, let's never look at this division again. I think there should be even more scrutiny on this division than they've ever had, because now we're asking the people to help pay for this. And so it's kind of a little bit of a warning, hey, we're going to continue to look at you, but I can't find another way to have the users pay for the service that is being provided here. And this is a really difficult one, but I think it's probably indicative of what we're probably going to expect in the next couple of years of trying to figure out how the utilizers of the services that we have asked state government to provide pay for the services for which we are, which state government is offering. And I think this is as close as we can get on this one to getting it to those that pay. So I will vote for it to move out, but I wanted to make it very clear on why, because this is a tough one. We're starting to go to the people to start paying for state government now, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief on, you know, we were talking about user fees, increasing user fees, making sure that people help pay and shoulder the burden of government. We've also talked a lot about this particular spill prevention and response fund, and I appreciate the sponsors' diligence in this. But it still doesn't equate, and the reason why I have trouble, I'll vote to move this out, but I still have trouble with the bill in its entirety, is that we still haven't figured out who the cost drivers are and how we get the cost drivers to pay that cost. And you can look at the volume of gallons of all products spilled in facility type by facility type. Mining operations is at 22%, but vehicles and residences are at 2 to 3%. I don't know if that's the cost driver necessarily, but it certainly is. Volume is certainly an indicator of that. Instead, we're going to put this on people who heat their homes with oil. We're going to put it on drivers that drive cars, utilities, and power plants that can pass that off on to consumers. Once again, people who have to pay for all the other things, and charitable institutions. And I just don't know if that's a fair way to do it. Absent a better way, though, today, if we're to move this bill out, I'd support moving it out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How do I feel?
How do you feel?
I see it that this is one way to reduce general fund spending next year. We'll be collecting some funds that means that they'll have more general funds available for other projects, such as education and public safety. So I am going to support the bill. As far as this is being spread around to everybody in the state, basically, and to say that we shouldn't do that would be like saying that majority of these people in this building, in this room, have no children in schools, but you're all paying school property tax. So that equates to how I feel about it also. It's like, you know, everybody's got to pay for something a little bit, and this is a small way to get this funded without using more general funds. So let's take a vote.
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
Yes.
Representative Gaddis?
No.
Representative Guttenberg?
No.
Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Representative Munoz?
Yes.
Representative Pruitt?
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Representative Newman?
No.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
7 yea, 4 nay.
So House Bill 158 version /I has moved from committee. The next House Finance, nobody leave till we sign the paperwork, please. The next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Thursday, April 2nd at 2015 at 1:30 p.m. At this meeting, we will have our second hearing of House Bill 41 and House Bill 49 and our first hearings on HB 155 and HB 100. And with that, at 4:15, we are adjourned.